and welcome to this Docs Are In Conversation. My name is Kate Holterhoff, Senior Analyst with Red Monk, and with me is my co-host and fellow Senior Analyst, Kelly Fitzpatrick, as well as our esteemed guest, Carol Lee, Principal Scientist at the Developer Success Lab at Pluralsight, a company that is all about technical training and onboarding. Carol is also a friend of Red Monk. She has spoken along with her colleagues at the 2023 Monktoberfest, and her talk entitled Using Evidence Science Instead of Mind Reading to Measure Developer Success was an absolute hit. And I have no doubt in my mind that the theme of using science will appear throughout today's conversation. Carol, thank you so much for speaking with us today. To start things off, can you tell us a little more about who you are and what you do?
Sure. Thank you for having me, first of all. So I'm a clinical scientist in the Developer Success Lab. What that basically means is that I'm a scientist who specializes in physical and mental health related issues. Because my background is in clinical psychology, obviously this is more about the mental health side of things. My expertise is in stress and anxiety. More specifically, it's this thing called mechanisms of change. What that really means is that it's like the stuff that really drives people to change, even when they're experiencing stress and anxiety. So kind of relating this back to Developer Success Lab, if you're a developer, you probably experience some anxiety at work, I'm guessing. Stress is probably very familiar to you. It's kind of looking at those aspects and those issues in developers and helping folks kind of grow through that.
And how did you end up in this position? What did you, you know, what was your sort of education and you know, your journey into it? Well, you know, to working at Pluralsight?
Yeah, I have kind of a very strange journey. I have a doctorate in clinical psychology, and that means that I'm, you know, trained to give therapy. My specialty was traumatic and anxiety-related disorders. Did that in specializing in sexual trauma for a long time, for like a few years, it felt like a long time. And then I moved into being a professor, which I absolutely loved. And at the same time, just kind of felt like there's this thing that happens when you're an academic where the people you're talking about your research to also research the thing that you research. And so it's a little bit of this echo chamber where you're like, mental health is important. And everyone's like, yeah, I know. Mental health is important. And you're like, yeah, I know. Awesome. And so this kind of thing happens. And then also at the same time, you know, a lot of scientific research is gatekept behind a lot of fees for people. So your general like person Googling can't actually read a lot of scientific literature because it's locked behind these publishing fees that are pretty like expensive, actually. So I try to kind of manage this by only publishing open access for a while, but then, you know, that kind of got old. And so really wanted to like make a difference and kind of share science more broadly. I'm really passionate about making science something that everyone feels like they can attain and kind of have access to, and particularly like rigorous science. And then at the same time, I have a really good friend who is a software developer and was kind of talking about their work. And I had this very strange realization that I'm sure everyone else is kind of very familiar with already in this space. Where I was like, hey, the world kind of runs on code. Or like, my hospital system like relies on code. Like the education system relies on code. So then I was like, well, what do developers, like what's up with developers? And the science on it is pretty dated. You know, like really relies on psychology research from like the 70s. And it's like research that was based on like five old white guys. And they're like, yay, we did the science thing. And I'm like, wow, like we could do so much better. So when Pluralsight developed this think tank style lab, the Developer Success Lab, it was just kind of a no-brainer. It was just really fun.
And it sounds like a very, very timely, a very timely thing to have, especially with what everyone's been going through for the past, like past yes. couple of years. I feel like anxiety is like, it's all our best friend now.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I hate the pandemic for a lot of things, and I really appreciate that the pandemic almost gave folks an excuse to say like, yeah, anxiety is a thing. I'm like, yes. And you've always had it, by the way. Right. So.
Yeah. You've always had it. And here are some better ways to maybe talk about it. And to that end, can you speak a little bit more about what is the clinical in clinical psychology kind of mean? It's a field that I don't know too much about, and you clearly do.
Yeah. So if you think about psychology as being like studying human thoughts, feelings, behaviors, emotions, et cetera. Clinical psychology is taking a look at how to work through, treat, assess, create interventions for kind of those maladaptive processes. So when those behaviors, thoughts, feelings, et cetera, are kind of getting in the way or are kind of not serving you in a positive way, really, clinical psychology really looks at like, okay, well, how do we assess and treat this?
And then also, you spoke a bit about, you know, Pluralsight and the Dev Success Lab, and Kate gave a bit of intro, but can you talk about the relationship between those two? And, you know, funny aside, Pluralsight is one of the kind of training resources that is suggested to you, and you are a member of like the ACM, which I am. And I was like, I noticed that just this week, and I was like, oh my goodness, this is very serendipitous.
That's so funny. Yeah. So I would say that the best way to describe us is that we are a think tank, academic research lab that's funded by a tech company, which is Pluralsight. So it's really nice. We do have academic freedom. And so that means that we don't do any product research. Our participants aren't users, which is really important to us. Something that's a really big pet peeve of mine, actually, is when folks do research and all their participants are from like the company they work at. Because now it's like, well, now we know a lot about your company, but not about literally everybody else, right? So that's not super generalizable to the general population. So that's a really big value of ours. And we're an open science lab. So that means that the science that we do, we really freely share with folks. This isn't something that you have to pay for. It's not like you have to be a Pluralsight user to access this. We're just kind of like, we really care about this science. We really think developers deserve science. And we just want to give it to you for free. So, yeah.
So a wonderful motive. And can you define what a think tank is exactly? I think I associate them with like DC politics and like lobbying.
No. It's basically like a group of people that get to like conduct research together to inform policies in the future, right? So in this case, our policy isn't, you know, a political thing. Our policy is like changing the tech world a little bit, right? Changing how folks in tech work or how folks see developers.
So you've recently written about the process of creating an institutional review board, or IRB for short, at Pluralsight specifically. And Kelly and I are both super familiar with IRBs from our time at Georgia Tech, where we both went through the certification process to serve as principal investigators. However, IRB is a term that you don't often hear in the tech industry, even though they can be crucial in setting and maintaining ethical standards. Can you speak a bit about the purpose of IRBs and why you felt Pluralsight needed one?
Yeah, so an IRB is essentially a group of people on a board, as you say. It serves as an ethics board, and their whole point is to make sure that researchers, people doing academic style research, is one, trained on the ethics of human research principles. So they're not making any kind of mistakes or accidentally putting people's data at risk, things like that. And then two, to actually make sure that folks' studies are being ethical as well. So every study that a person completes or kind of runs, they need to get IRB approval ahead of time. So it's not like an ethics board is like, oh man, you shouldn't have done that, right? It's like, you say, here's everything I'm going to do. The ethics board looks at it and says, okay, here's where I have questions. Here's where I don't have questions. You need to change this. Give me more information on this, et cetera, et cetera. And then you go ahead and do that study. If you have any changes that you make, you actually have to go back to the ethics board and say, oh, sorry, I'm actually going to do this other thing instead now. I'm going to add this other thing. And the ethics board has to approve those changes as well. Mm-hmm. So it's really just a board that approves your study to make sure you're being ethical. Mm-hmm. So the reason why I think that Pluralsight needed one is that, honestly, just kind of the nature of our research, you don't see IRBs a lot in industry because a lot of folks tend to do kind of very lightweight survey research. So to be fair, a lot of industry research would be qualified what we call as in the exempt category. That means that an IRB will kind of like briefly look at the proposal and say, doesn't really need review, like go ahead, do it. There's like no or very minimal risk here. And this is where a lot of industry research falls under. But if you want to start moving into kind of deeper human experiences, right? So things like mental health or kind of job security or fears, things like that. Or if you want to start doing more rigorous methods, so moving beyond survey research, and moving into things like experiments, right? Or intervention work, which is like my favorite thing in the world. So if you want to start doing that kind of work, then you do want an IRB. You know, it's not legally required to like have an IRB in an industry kind of research lab, but it is just kind of ethically sound to do that. I think like on a personal note too, I just like the idea of having extra eyes on my work. Maybe it's, you know, just a result of being a psychologist, or maybe it's my background in being an academic, but people make mistakes all the time, right? Like we often don't know what we are biased against or for because they're our own biases, right? So like I've had, you know, people, I've had IRBs come back and say things like, hey, you actually want to explain that, you know, that you're going to ask about these things before you actually ask about it. I'm like, oh, you're right. Like, I'm so used to asking about these things that I didn't think about the fact that somebody might be like, whoa, why are you asking me about this? Right. And so kind of, so having those checks and balances is really nice. I think anytime you're working with humans in research, you want to be really prioritizing the humans that you're working with, right? Like, that's kind of important. As researchers, we have a lot of power over the people that we're, you know, conducting research on. And so I just think it's important to respect that.
I love that. And yeah. Having recently gone through, like, I've had to do, like, recertify myself for the Georgetech IRB, because you have to do that every few years. And one of the things that struck me this time around was the questions and the kind of guidance around safeguarding people's data and privacy, which are things that I feel like people care about more and more these days.
Yeah, I think that something that, something that I think is not maybe really understood about academic research is that in order to have IRB approval, your data has to be private and secure, right? Mm-hmm. So what that means is that nobody else but the researchers have access to it. So for example, with our data, Pluralsight does not have access to our data ever. This is like our data, right? Only the researchers have access to the raw data. Obviously, when you report on it, like do aggregated like scores and things like that, that goes out into the public. But raw data is like researchers only. I think something that often surprises people is that like things like IP addresses that violates IRB rules, right? So like we don't collect IP addresses, for example, because that's a pretty big no-no to the IRB because that's violating privacy. So I think there are these like little things that folks may not think about, but that the IRB does, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I tend to think of traditional IRBs as protecting, you know, the rights of children and like neonatal, you know, entities, so pregnant women, prisoners, things like that. But yeah, this sort of new realm of digital rights also comes into it, which I think is useful and kind of you know, looks forward and it's probably would inform a lot of the research that you're doing at the think tank.
Yeah, I remember when I was in grad school, right, we kept all our patient data in like locked file cabinets in a locked room inside a locked office that nobody except the researchers had access to. And so you didn't have to think about, you know, these things like, oh, well, we did a digital intervention. And so now all the data is online. It's instead just like, oh, you like have to have the key. And if you lose the key, like the whole thing, it changed the locks. And, you know, so it's a very different kind of thing to be aware of. So, yeah.
I also like how you, when you characterize it as almost like a reader too, like a like a part of peer review where you're looking for readers who are going to view, you know, kind of before the research is even out, you know, your ideas for a study, your thesis, your the methods that you're going to employ with that critical lens. And can intervene and say, hey, you know, I have some suggestions here. I think you're on the right track, but here's some ways that I would tweak it. But yeah, I'm with you. Actually, Kelly and I joke a lot about peer review because, of course, it has a lot of issues. But in general, there's a lot of merit to it, right? And if only for the fact that you have someone that you're in conversation with about your research. And of course, all of us who have done the academic thing get very excited about the things that we study. And so the fact that, you know, at least one person is reading it and they're willing to challenge you and compliment you on things that are going well. I mean, that's a real boon. I mean, that's something that I actually, in my most recent book, I devote some time in the acknowledgments to the blind readers. I don't know who they are, but I am so grateful to them for taking the time out of their schedules to really dig into my argument. So yeah. In any event, I haven't really thought about IRB in quite that way. And so I really appreciate your perspective there.
Yeah, I kind of think of it as like, the peer review process can be brutal sometimes, right? Like sometimes you're like, oh, yeah. This person, I hate you. And then other times you're like, wow, such an amazing like review. I never thought about that. Love it. It's like all about tone half the time. But I often think about like our research projects as like our babies. And like, you really hate it when someone's like, man, your baby's ugly. You know, like that's what it feels like oftentimes. Right. But you also want to know, like, if you're doing something really horribly wrong. And so I kind of feel like the IRB is like this, like, helpful, I don't know, expert who's like, hey, like, maybe you shouldn't do that with baby. And you're like, you're right. Like, baby probably doesn't love that. And people may not love that. And it kind of feels like, hey, you keep someone saying like, hey, you're a bad parent, or like, hey, you have an ugly baby, but like, that's not really what's happening, right? They're just like trying to be helpful. But it does mean that who's on your IRB board matters a lot. And that is something that like we thought about very, very carefully. Because sometimes you get a bad IRB board and it's just full of people who just want to like make you happy. And you're like, well, I don't want you to make me happy. I want you to make me better, right? So yeah.
I love that idea that you don't want your board to be entirely made up of people pleasers. You want kind of that rigor. And I think going back to this argument that you've made, which I think is great, about how IRBs facilitate scientifically rigorous research in applied settings. Can you speak about how this is playing out in your current or recent research? Like for instance, I know that you have been working on code review anxiety, which is a topic I think many technical practitioners get, but I feel like your clinical psychology training and adherence to scientific rigor leads to a different approach than what we often get through like tech industry thought leadership.
Yes. Yes. This is like a topic that's super near and dear to my heart. One of my like major expertise areas is social anxiety. And you can think about code review anxiety as like a type of social anxiety. It's performance-based, evaluative, and there's a social aspect to it, right? It's like hitting all the pieces of social anxiety. And so something that I think is wild is that when you look at how developers like manage code review anxiety, there's like a bunch of research, not research, literature, I will say, like books or like self-help, whatever, blog posts out there that are like code review, we all have it. Or code review anxiety, we all have it. And then they're like, here's how to write better code, which is like a little bit wild to me. Like it's kind of like saying, hey, sucks that you're feeling not great about yourself. Have you thought about being just a better person? And you're like, that's like the worst thing you can say to somebody with anxiety, right? It's like supremely unhelpful.
Why don't you just not be anxious and be better at the thing you're worried about?
Exactly. Nope. Like, oh, that's so weird that you're depressed. Have you thought about not being sad? No. Yeah. So it's kind of like that similar messaging that developers are getting all the time when they're dealing with code review anxiety. So I really wanted to create something that's more evidence-based, based on actual cognitive behavioral therapy principles. So I made this workshop, right? But to make this workshop, I need to get IRB approval because it's now an intervention. We're kind of diving deeper into kind of more intense human experiences like anxiety. I'm getting a lot of folks in this study where that have actually quite high code review anxiety, for example. And so that was kind of a big piece of what the IRB lets us do is say, hey, I know you're going to do this deeper dive into this. Let's, you know, make sure that this workshop is helpful, not harmful, right? Let's make sure that this workshop actually like looks like it's legit. It's not just like hot takes. It's a real, you know, based on a real thing. And there's a good reason for why you're doing it. And let's also make sure that when you're asking people about their anxious experiences, you're doing it in an ethical way, right? What's also really cool is that in most clinical work, you'll see something called a randomized clinical trial or a randomized controlled trial. So this is also an RCT, we call them. And so having an IRB actually allows you to move beyond survey research, which really only can give you kind of correlational data most of the time, and actually move into kind of experimental data. So moving away from correlation and into causation. So it's pretty cool.
I feel like I've just learned 100 things in that one. Like that one section of our discussion today. And
Mm-hmm. No, I just wanted to point out that like one of the things that I loved about your article on this, Carol, is that you actually move from just like, this is a problem to how do you set up an IRB board within your own organization? So you like actually, as Kelly is pointing to, like the being solutions oriented, like giving a blueprint for how to create this and just going beyond the like, this is a problem and here's why you should care.
Yeah, I appreciate that because I really didn't want it to be something that was like, oh, look how special I am. I have an IRB, but more about like, and you can't have one, right? But more about like, look, if I have an IRB, you should get one too, right? Because I think oftentimes
yeah, don't know IRBs for everyone.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, we all love ethics. Woo, ethics for everybody. So yeah, I really, I did my best to kind of like lay out some simple steps. It actually wasn't super like horribly hard. You just, you know, got to get your good board together. And granted, writing the handbook and the manual, I definitely had some like prior expertise there from being on an IRB board at an academic institution. So I can see that being like a harder step for most people. But yeah, I mean, it was, you know, getting it officially registered wasn't too bad.
I have got to hear about your work on illustrations here. So published a little bit on that subject myself. Always get excited when, some of our clients have marketectures on their website. Love digging into visuals. And I just think they're super important. So I have got to hear about your own illustration, your own forays into visual communication. So you've created a webcomic called Thriving Blobs. Can you tell us about it?
Yes. Zooming out a little bit, have you all heard of Hyperbole and a Half? It's like this like webcomic series that was out like 90s, 2000s, maybe something like that.
I don't know that I have. Tell me about it.
It is like really bad art. I mean, the person, like the author, like admits it's like really bad art. She's just like, I don't know. Like, I don't even care. Clearly done on like paint or like PowerPoint or something like that. But she really excels at talking about tough things in a really real and approachable way. So when I would teach abnormal psychology or like helping skills, things like that, I'd always make my students read about a comic she wrote about depression. And it was like very, very approachable and real, and really talks about depression in a way that is kind of like lived experience and matter of fact, but also very funny. Right? Like kind of like a dark humor. And that's always really stuck with me. It's always been something that like my students in the past were like, yeah, I get it now. Right? Like, they're like, oh, I get why you shouldn't say like, just be happier. I get why you shouldn't just like throw solutions at people now. Like, I totally get it. Just like really amazing work. And so I've always had this kind of fondness for this web comic thing in communicating like tough or kind of technical work. So when we were talking about kind of communicating about developer thriving, I kind of had this like inkling of, oh, it would be really fun to do a comic, but I don't want me to do the comic. I just want like the comic to happen because I'm not an artistic person and I like don't really want to draw, you know? So like I didn't suggest it at the time because I was like, I bet if I say someone to do a comic, someone's going to be like, well, why don't you do a comic? And I'll be like, good question. So then I like secretly started doing this comic. Just like to see what I could do. Very rudimentary art. It's like literally blobs with some faces on them, and started like writing up what I would want to say if I were like talking about writing to my friend. Made a few panels and just like kind of randomly put them in my team Slack and was like, I made this. my manager was like, well, I love it. What is it? And I was like, it's a comic. Do you want me to do it? And she was like, yeah, like just go for it. Like, who cares? So it's really fun because, you know, I think that as scientists, folks sometimes think that you are in this field and you're serious the whole time and you're just like, oh yeah, this is science. And I frown the entire time and I'm not like playing with my work. But actually science is a really playful field. You get to play with methods. You get to play around with, you know, how you're going to measure something. You're going to play around with how you're going to present something. And it's a really fun and dynamic process, right? And I kind of wanted to kind of emanate that, like, joy of play in some ways into this comic while I was talking about thriving. Like, hey, like, when I think about thriving, I'm not just thinking about it as a scientist. I'm thinking about it as, like, the human that really loves people and like really wants people to enjoy good things and have good things happen to them, right? So that was kind of like the process behind it, I suppose, and turned out pretty good.
Turned out amazing. Are you planning on doing more webcomics?
I am. I have one in draft right now. Yeah, this time Blobs get a pet, which is a something called a sheep cat dog. So watch out for that. Sheep cat dog is sheep cat dog because it's the only animal I could make on PowerPoint. And it was determined it was a mix of a sheep cat and dog. So I was like,
I was wondering what your method was. Is it for like, or what tool you were using to create this? You're using PowerPoint? I love that so much. If our colleague Rachel Stevens was on here, she would use Excel. She would find a way.
Yes. Yeah. 100% on PowerPoint. It's very, very
unusual. Now I'm here. Hey. I'm here for the Excel created webcomic now, though.
Yeah.
No, Rachel.
No pressure, Rachel. Yeah.
No. No, Rachel and I can do a little team up. I would love that.
I love this so much. Yeah. But and kind of going back, you know, Carol, to the whole idea of like the comic making thing is just kind of like real and accessible. You know, for me, I think you've made this the entire field of clinical psychology real and accessible. And I think for many people out there, the concept of IRBs as well. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you both.
All right. And again, your co-host today have been Kate Holterhoff and Kelly Fitzpatrick, senior analyst with RedMonk. And I want to thank Carol for joining us today. You can learn. Well, actually, let me ask you, where should we learn more about what you're up to, Carol?
You can check out our website at devsuccesslab.com. Pretty easy to remember. Just check it out and see what we're up to.
And are you on any social media platforms these days?
I am. I'm on both Mastodon and LinkedIn. So you can find me there as well.
Fantastic. If you enjoyed this conversation, please like, subscribe, and review the MonkCast on your podcast platform of choice. If you are watching us on YouTube, please like, subscribe, and engage with us on the comments.